You're listening to DVD Talk Radio.
Greetings, pod people. This is CineSchlockerama columnist Noel Gross, and one of the things I enjoy most about doing this column is that I run across films that are surprising and interesting and just plain weird sometimes, and I get to share them with you, the CineSchlockers. And Skin Deep is a film that fits that description to a T. This is from Fangoria's own video line. I think it's called Gore Zone. And frankly, those pictures don't tend to interest me. I've seen different ones, and you read the magazine to get all the hype. Oh, it's going to be a great picture. You watch it, and it turns out to be something less than they promise. Well, Skinned Deep is going to make me rethink that stance on Fangoria's video line, because it's one of the most interesting and entertaining flicks that I've seen in a long time. It comes from Gabe Bartolus. He worked with Frank Henenlotter on the Basket Case sequels, as in the FX side. I worked on Brain Damage also. More recently, he's worked on the Leprechaun pictures, which of course are very near and dear to our hearts as CineSchlockers. And finally, he's done his own film, and I hope it's the first of many, because he's really got an inventive eye, and you're just going to have to see this picture to believe it, really. But I'll try to muddle through and give you a little bit of the highlights. Plot-wise, the film follows sort of the Texas Chainsaw Hills Have Eyes model, because it involves one family that encounters another family who means to do them much harm. And Gabe's family is like none other that you've probably seen. Maybe it's a little bit similar to sort of the Basket Case sequels, but we've got the main baddie of the group, the key homicidal maniac, and he is called the Surgeon General. And he's easy to pick out because, well, he's on the cover, and second of all, he's got this bear trap for a mouth, which makes him quite the imposing figure. Then the leader is of the group is this sweet, wonderful grandmother that if you encounter and she invites you to dinner, you very much should not go, as sweet and nice and lovable as she appears to be, which is what Carolyn Brandt finds out. She is Tina Rockwell. The whole Rockwell clan is killed before her very eyes. And then she is saved mostly to be the love slave of Brain, who is this dopey little guy that has, this giant melon of a head. I feel sorry for the actor who has to wear the big appliance, because you can literally see him tip into frame every time he has a scene. Yet he's able to still make this character quite lovable and sort of the antithesis of all of his other killer kin. Also, there is someone who's going to be very obvious to CineSchlockers is Warwick Davis, who, of course, starred in the Leprechaun pictures that I just mentioned earlier. But he was also probably in his most frightening role was that of Wicket in the horrible, scary Return of the Jedi. You know, all those scary Ewoks. Oof. I love his character in this picture. He's not submerged under, gobs of makeup. It's just lovable Warwick there. And his means of killing are beautiful porcelain plates that he carries in a backpack, that he has some sort of mechanism that ejects them above his head. And then he throws them like, razor blade saucers that decapitate people and make a real mess of things. And Warwick has these great monologues about the purity of porcelain and all this sort of weird stuff. I guess I should talk a little bit about Tina. She's sort of an interesting character. The typical... I guess there's really nothing typical about this picture, but, as horror films go, she's the final girl, as they say. She's the girl that suffers all the indignities and, nearly gets killed 90 different ways, but makes it through, each time, and then eventually, hopefully, lives toward the end of the film. While Gabe trades in familiar horror conventions like that, it's always with a little bit of a bent. And the picture even looks weird. It seems as though it's shot exclusively with a fisheye lens. Everything has this sort of compressed, otherworldly view. The sets look like there's some sort of cross between Pee-wee's Playhouse and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Rooms filled with bodies or rooms papered completely in newsprint. It's very disorienting. There's this dream sequence where Brain puts on an Indian headdress and sprints through the streets of New York in his birthday suit. It's just one thing after another. Some things about the DVD that you should know before you make this very important purchase, which I highly recommend, is that you buy this 4.5-star rated picture. I felt like the commentary sort of left a little bit to be desired. It went through the basics of explaining what was what and how they did everything. But I found the making of documentary more engaging, entertaining, and I guess it's difficult not to be engaging and entertaining when the director makes all of his comments from the floor of a slaughterhouse, with cows being, butchered and meat being harvested in the background. They have the behind the scenes of how they did the human scarification for the main title sequence. And what that is they heat up a piece of metal and they touch it to human flesh and it sears and scars. Well, that's how they made the title sequence, and they show the person that agreed to do that and actually was very thrilled to do so. So you also get a little window into the fetish world with the behind-the-scenes documentary. They explain some of the explosions that pepper the final reel and how they were able to capture some of the fantastic demolition work that really rivals any sort of Hollywood blockbuster. It was shot on 16mm full frame aspect ratio, so when you pop in the DVD, don't panic. Yes, it's meant to be full frame. But most of all, just hang in for the final credits of the film, because they're truly a scream, to put it very directly. 3.5 minutes of screaming, actually. So if you had any question mark forming over your head while you're watching the movie, when the credits roll, I think that question mark's going to turn into a very long 3.5-minute smile for CineSchlockers. This is a great picture, and I can't imagine it's not going to be among the top 10 schlock titles of the year. And let's hope for another film very soon from Mr. Gabe Bartolus. Something that's not quite so engaging or entertaining would be Dracula 3 Legacy. Now, I expected to enjoy this picture a lot more than I did. I was a fan of Dracula 2000, which launched this would-be franchise. And I actually enjoyed Dracula 2 Ascension a little bit more than the first. I rated that 3 stars and rated the first picture 2.5 stars. And this one is barely going to eke up to 2 stars. I just didn't buy it. Dracula 2 and 3, now follow me here, they were shot together on the same budget of about $36 there in Romania. Dracula 3 follows the same holy heine kicker, Jason Scott Lee, as he, flogs himself and feels bad about, being bitten by a vampire and, he's fighting off the sickness or whatever, and he has to wear dark glasses and then kills anyone who looks the least bit pale or, eats a steak a little too rare. Of course, Jason Scott Lee is, ready to whoop ass at a moment's notice and whip off his shirt and flex his muscles. But he really doesn't have much to work with here. And the situation sure doesn't improve when Rutger Hauer shows up in the final reel as Dracula. For some reason, Dracula is obsessed with television. He's got all sorts of satellite dishes on his castle. I don't think they ever really explain that. It's just a mess all the way around. You do get a appearance by CineSchlocker idol Gary Tunnicliffe. He's the great FX artist that has severed more heads than just about anybody in the business these days. He gets a sort of a walk-on role as a TV cameraman that runs around terrified and then actually gets his face melted. So good job, Gary. Great to see you. Gary also shows up on the commentary with his director buddy Patrick and producer slash writer buddy Joel. If any of you have checked out Project Greenlight, you may remember Joel because he was the producer on Feast by the great John Gulager. Can't wait to see that. And finally, while we're on the subject of films shot back-to-back, we've got Hotties and Hotties 2, The Hot, The Bad, and The Ugly. How about that for a creative title? These are from Lee Bennett Sobel, and I kind of admire Lee. His first picture, Rockabilly Vampire, he released through Troma. And after that, he decided, you know, I'm going to release these darn things myself. And he just has been churning out movie after movie. All with his own sort of wit and whimsy. And I think he's really got something with Hotties. It's about these three crazed Russ Meyer-type vixens who escape from a mental institution and run wild across New Jersey. All of these luscious ladies are going to be very familiar to Cineschlockers because they're veterans of seduction cinema pictures. Chief among them, of course, is Julian Wells. She first came to our attention with Dr. Jekyll and Mistress Hyde, in which she co-starred with Misty Monday. Then there was Spider Babe, which she also co-starred with Misty Monday. Here she co-stars with the lovely, lovely Erica Smith. She absolutely stole a little picture called The Sexy Adventures of Van Helsing. She was very funny. Here she does the Bronx accent. Sounds a lot like Harley Quinn from the Batman cartoon series. And it sure doesn't hurt that Erica is especially easy on the eyes. But that's certainly no slide against the final member of our trio, and that's Caitlin Ross, who also co-starred in Bite Me, along with Julian Wells and Misty Monday. Eagle-eyed Cineschlockers will also be quick to notice that A.J. Kahn makes an appearance in the picture, and I think she's the only one that's not doing a crazy accent or some sort of put-on voice. Lee tends to enjoy having these actors do these voices. He likes these over-the-top characters. And Julian Wells, she does the same voice she did for Sexy American Idol. That's I-D-L-E. See how different that is? It's the little American Idol parody that Seduction Cinema did. She does this, you know, goofy accent in that picture and does the same one here. I already mentioned that Erica does her little Harley Quinn voice. Caitlin does the sort of ooga booga kind of voice from because she's some sort of jungle babe. There's a bounty hunter called Mad Dog. Probably the funniest is James Eason's mad scientist that's responsible for sexing up the Hotties in the first place. He plucked them out of the insane asylum and shot them full of all sorts of sexifying drugs that make them go on their rampage across New Jersey. And he especially benefits from the fact that the movie is completely unscripted. It's sort of like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. They have a basic outline and they work from there, making up their own dialogue, ad-libbing as they will, and it works really well. It's very funny, and especially it's interesting to watch the three girls work together. They don't really step over each other's lines, and they all are able to get in their little funny bits, and it works especially well. But I think you'll see in Hotties 2 that James takes full advantage of this improv ability of his, because he creates this doctor character that can go on and riff, and it's unbelievably funny. Well, at least for a movie where laxatives are a major plot device. Now, if you actually want to see these pictures, you've got to go to lofientertainment.com. That's lofientertainment.com. And there you can buy each movie for about $20, or if you're really smart, you'll buy both movies for $25. I guess that's a pretty good deal. Personally, though, I'd kind of like to see both movies on the same disc. I think that the pictures work pretty well together, and that it would be kind of fun to have a old-style intermission and then switch over into the second part of the picture and maybe cut down the front half and the back half and have a good 90-minute comedy. But you are getting your money's worth. There's on the first disc, there's a commentary and a little outtake reel. And the skimpy running time of Hotties 2 is balanced out with a 20-minute audition reel and an amusing little short film called Sex Freaks. And once you've waded through all that, you pretty much know what Lee Bennett Sobel's been spending all of his time on. I've been spending my time recently listening to Bruce Campbell's new audiobook, or as he's calling it, an audio movie, because it runs a lot like a radio play. It's a 6-disc version of his hit Make Love the Bruce Campbell Way, which, of course, is his sophomore effort after If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. It's a real hoot, certainly great for those busy cineschlockers out there and for those functionally illiterate cineschlockers. I've clipped off a little 5-minute sample. Give a listen and see what you think.
I want to pitch a book to you. I think you're a great match for the material.
What is it?
A relationship book. I'm serious. I can get that book approved.
Well, yeah, but Barry, wow, that's a whole new deal.
Relationship books are huge. If you win with one of these, you win big.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about that and call you back. I'd have to see if I can get my head around it.
Okay, sure, I understand. Take your time. The offer stands.
As I hung up, I pitied Barry. Poor bastard. My editor still remembered me from the TV show The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., where I successfully managed a new girlfriend almost every week. He couldn't shake the images of my character Ash from the film Army of Darkness, where I coolly manhandled my leading lady with lines like, "Gimme some sugar, baby." He'd see me up close and personal with some damn sexy women the likes of Vanessa Angel, Alyssa Milano, and Elizabeth Hurley. So in the world, according to Barry, I was the living embodiment of a chick magnet, the perfect choice to write a relationship book. Barry's a nice guy, but he's also a fool. What he fails to realize is that the Bruce Campbell who romanced his way through a succession of beautiful leading women bears no resemblance to the Bruce Campbell who forgets anniversaries and hoards Victoria's Secret catalogs. In the real world, none of what he sees on the silver screen relates to me, the actor, or any actor for that matter. Let me walk you through a few of the key differences. For starters, love scenes are never the result of an actor's romantic prowess or insistence. These are obligatory elements of any cinematic romance story, and actors in leading roles are often confronted with them. In reality, shooting a love scene is about as exciting as groping my sister, and thankfully I don't have one. Actors don't make up all that clever dialogue. I'll throw in a quip or two, sure, but I'm mainly hired to say words that are written for me. And when it comes to scenes about relationships, I'm happy to have the help of a clever writer who is, at the end of the day, manipulating a given situation into how it could play out, not how it would. As an actor, I don't have any say in how the relationship will go, or even who my romantic partner will be. The writer has determined my on-screen fate far in advance, and that's a really scary thought, because the only people who have worse relationships than actors are writers, because they spend most of their time alone, never talking to anyone, staring at a computer screen. Hollywood is successful at portraying relationships because it manages to bring our fantasies to life. It presents a what-if world in which we can lose ourselves for a few hours. In movies, when it comes to men and women, everything happens at the speed of light. Couples fall in love at first glance. Later, during sex, which happens on the first date, men get instant erections and can make love for hours. Women achieve orgasm in record time, some going for 3 in a row. The sex will always be good, and it must be always in some imaginative place like a freight elevator or a nuclear submarine. Poor Barry. I can see why he was so confused. Like all of us, he'd been brainwashed for years. Aside from all that, what the hell does a guy who lost his virginity at age 23 know about the opposite sex? Jack shit, that's what. When it comes to women, I don't know my ass from a hole in the ground. I learned about sex through the mass marketing of the early 60s, when Fred Flintstone was doing cigarette ads and products like space food sticks, Tang, and leaded gasoline were the order of the day. Sex back then meant sleeping in separate beds, closed-mouth kissing, wearing PJs to bed, even adults, and no sex before marriage. No wonder I had such a bogus view of the world. As my female awareness sprang to life in the late 60s, the sexy babes on television at the time were Anita Bryant, a conservative singer selling orange juice, Julie Newmar, who played Catwoman in the TV show Batman, and Marta Kristen, the teenage daughter on Lost in Space. I didn't know right from left, but I can tell you this. It wasn't the intricate plots or the acting that held my attention. It was the way these foxy women filled out their skin-tight costumes week after week. Women didn't seem like people who had sex. They just wore lots of makeup and smelled funny. Sears catalogs and later my dad's Playboys helped straighten a few things out, but there were more questions than answers. Motion pictures often wind up being an early vital source of insight into the sexual dynamics between men and women. Problem was, I couldn't get into any movie that might have been of use to me, the cursed M rating for mature audiences only. So my model for intergender relationships came primarily from John Wayne Westerns between 1962 and 1973. My mother, Joanne, was a huge Western fan, and since my father couldn't have cared less, she dragged me along instead. Given my prolonged exposure to the bizarre archetypal behavior of cowboys, I shouldn't have been surprised then by an incident on the playground when I was 9. I rescued a girl who was being harassed by a bully, a cattle rustler as I saw it, by socking him once in the jaw. That's all Duke ever needed, and down he went. I grabbed the girl, the feed store owner's daughter Sue, whipped her around and kissed her butt good. Closed mouth, because we did such things proper then. To my shock and horror, Sally Sue Jenkins slapped me across the face.
Hey, get out of here, you weirdo. My brother was just trying to give me lunch money.
Sorry, ma'am. Didn't mean to cause no fuss.
Dating? I was too busy making amateur films in high school to take advantage of those prime years. Relationships? That's a good one. The relationships in my civilian life can be counted on one hand, minus the use of my thumb. Don't come knocking here, brother. I married the first woman who ever came on to me. The weight of hypocrisy would be too much to bear if I wrote a book about a subject on which I was essentially retarded.
All right, Cineschlockers, I don't think we can top a Bruce Campbell audiobook, so I think that's it for another Schlockcast. Let's do a quick review. We had Skinned Deep. That's 4.5 stars and comes highly recommended. We had Dracula 3 Legacy, and that's just 2 stars, and I'm going to say rent that one. And finally, we had Hotties and Hotties 2, The Hot, the Bad, and the Ugly. Between them, they're going to split 2.5 stars, and I'm going to recommend both discs, if only to encourage Lee's Lo-Fi Entertainment to keep the babelicious schlock flowing. Until next time, this has been Cineschlockerama columnist Noel Gross. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to DVD Talk Radio. Find DVD Talk Radio online at dvdtalkradio.com.